You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Yo, what is going on, everybody? Welcome to Show Me the Meaning, Wisecracks Movie Podcast.
Show me the
Alright, I am Austin, and I am joined here with by the Show Me the Meaning crew. We've got Ryan.
How's it going? Oh, sup, film fans. That's what I said.
Gotta stick to the script, brother. Yeah, and we've got Raymond.
Bababa Duke Duke Duke. How's it going, everybody?
Right on. Well, if people couldn't tell with the intros, we are going to be talking about Jennifer Kent's 2014 horror masterpiece, The Babadook. It's a little bit spooky and scary, sort of Halloween themed, although indirectly because it has nothing to do with Halloween. But we're talking about like monsters and shit. So I guess that's kind of Halloween-y. Yeah.
Yeah. So, totally yeah. Halloween-y. This is a Halloween-y movie for sure.
All right. Cool. Well, so before we get
into an Aussie Halloween-y.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So before we get into the recap and the specifics of the film, let's talk about our first impressions and then what it was like rewatching the film. Let's start with Raymond.
Oh, sure. I watched this when it first came out back in 2014. I checked it out on VOD and I hadn't watched it since, but it made a really big impression then. A lot of scares that stuck with me, and it was a real pleasure to rewatch it, especially so close to Halloween like this. It's a nice little mood piece, gets you in a spooky mood, and I'm excited to talk about it with you guys. I was really, really glad to hear you introduce this as Jennifer Kent's masterpiece, because I do think it's great. So it's good to hear that maybe I'm not going to be alone in my enthusiasm on this one.
Has she made many movies?
She's made two. She's working on a third now.
Oh, okay, and already made her masterpiece.
Wow. Have either of you seen her follow-up,
yeah.
Nightingale?
I have not.
Yeah, it's very good.
I would really recommend it, Ryan. It's not as, what would I say? It's more earthy. It's more grounded. It's got a little bit more specifics with
this regards to this movie had a lot of earthworms in it. More earthy than this movie.
Well, it's not straightforward horror. It doesn't have the fantasy elements. But it is. It's a pretty brutal film, but it's still really, really good and definitely worth the watch.
Definitely.
Out of my list.
So, Ryan, what do you think about The Babadook? First time seeing it, rewatching it?
I'm very glad that we decided to do this because my first time was like a filmmaker's worst nightmare. Where I'm, if Jennifer Kent watched me see it the first time, she would have had a heart attack because I was like half paying attention, kind of parts of it. I was just like, I heard the movie was cool, but you know, especially for a horror movie, you can't watch a horror movie like that. You got to be focused, you know, in the zone. And I do remember thinking that the atmosphere was sweet. The Babadook itself was cool. The little kid was awesome. I will say that my one big takeaway was I didn't really care for the ending the first time I saw it. And I didn't know really how to parse the ending. Now I feel like after actually sitting down and watching it like I should have the first time, I like it a lot more, especially the ending. It's a weird, vague way to end your movie. Not vague, but you know, there's a lot to be discussed about the end and why she ended it that way and what it all means and the metaphors involved and stuff. And I think that this movie is really cool.
Yeah.
At the end of the day.
Yeah, it's tough. The first time I saw it, there was so much hype around this film, right? And I always feel like I'm a failure if I don't buy into the hype. And, you know, it's those like external pressures because you want to fit in or you're just told that something's great. And then when you first experience it, if it doesn't live up to that hype, you're like, fuck, either I didn't understand something or I missed something. So that's kind of how I felt. I felt like I just didn't quite get it. And then I rewatched it this time. And to be completely honest, I think I had a similar experience with Ryan. I don't even remember what my first viewing was, but I don't think I was paying attention because I don't know why I wouldn't have been gripped the first time seeing it because I really think this is fucking fantastic. Now, I have read about a dozen or two dozen think pieces and like philosophical analyses and psychoanalytic.
Yeah, you can fill me in.
Yeah, I will. We will talk about those things. But since then, right? And so I think maybe that gave me a little bit of extra material to work with going into this film rather than just going in with just this like vague hype. So my first time was kind of a letdown, But then this viewing was absolutely fantastic. I get it. It is a masterpiece. I do think it's wonderful. I just listened to a review by Mark Kermode where he says that he thinks that Jennifer Kent kind of changed the face of modern horror with this release. And I think that there's something we could talk about in there that I think is probably pretty accurate. Like films like It Follows, this. I think that there's something about maybe like a post-horror genre dealing with psychological thrillers or whatever that we can talk about. And I think there's a lot to work with. So I think the film is absolutely amazing. And I actually can't – I've been really excited, just brimming all morning since it's morning here, evening there. But to talk about this film with you guys.
Great.
So I say we jump
and,
into the
– And you're where – the you're in Australia, right?
Yeah.
So you're right there at ground zero for this. This is a cool collaboration.
Yeah, and I wonder if that actually kind of – increased my enjoyment of it because it takes place in Australia. I've learned a little bit about Australian horror films, you know, Australian Gothic. And then of course they do like Outbacky films. And I love Razorback. Wake and Fright. Razorback is great.
Wake and Fright's a great one.
Wake and Fright is one of the best. Yeah. Like if people don't know about Australian cinema, check out the documentary, Not Quite Hollywood.
Ozploitation
cinema in the 70s when the government was just throwing money at these filmmakers. And some of the best films that we get, some of the best characters, you know, Road Warrior, Mad Max, Razorback, Alan Partridge, some of these classic characters come out from that time period. So it's amazing. Quentin Tarantino famously says that like some of these Australian films are his favorite. So Not Quite Hollywood, check that out. I think that sets some of the background for my enjoyment of this film.
That's a good doc. That's a good recommendation. And I am curious as we get into this, if there's anything about Australian culture that maybe popped out to you that Ryan and I might not have picked up on.
Oh shit. No pressure from me.
No. I'm just curious if there was anything,
the cultural
that,
anthropologist
anything that
here.
Comes to mind.
All right, cool. Well, let's jump into the recap. So, an Australian Gothic monster in the domestic world genre film. The Babadook centers on single mother Amelia and her son Samuel, who are attempting to build a normal life in suburban Adelaide, nearly 7 years after the death of Oscar, the husband and father, who was killed in a car accident while driving Amelia to the hospital to give birth to Sam. Experiencing survivor's guilt, self-loathing, and blaming Samuel, Amelia struggles to maintain suburban appearances. Meanwhile, Samuel has an overactive imagination and displays increasingly difficult behavior, leaving him to be removed from school. One night, Amelia reads a pop-up storybook to Samuel before bed. Titled Mr. Babadook, this story shows a monstrous figure who haunts its victims. Disturbed from this content, Amelia hides the book. Sam, however, becomes more and more convinced that the Babadook is real and is in fact haunting them. Slowly, the effects of this Babadook become more and more real, leading to greater erratic and delusional behavior from Amelia and deeper conviction from Samuel that the Babadook is, in fact, real. Amelia takes the book, tears it apart, only to find it on their doorstep the next morning, reassembled. So she burns the book and reports to the police that she and her son are being stalked. However, while in the police station, the police don't really take her claim seriously, and when the officer notices black chalk on her hands, his suspicion peaks, leading Amelia to abruptly leave the police station. Amelia gets more isolated, and she eventually goes full-on monstrous feminine by being fully possessed by the Babadook. She strangles the family dog and ultimately attempts to kill Sam. Sam, however, escapes and ties her up in the basement, but she's able to get her hands free, and she starts strangling Sam. Then he lovingly caresses her face and leaving her to relent from choking him, causing her to puke up some black gunk, which expels the Babadook from within her. But Sam reminds her that you can't fully get rid of the Babadook. So there's a final showdown where Amelia furiously confronts the Babadook, making it retreat to the basement of the house. The film closes with things apparently having been resolved between Amelia and Sam. And at his 7th birthday party, Sam collects earthworms in a bowl and gives them to Amelia, where she takes the bowl down into the basement where the monster is still residing, and initially it lunges at her to attack her, but she calms it down and offers the bowl of worms as a little treat slash sacrifice to placate it. Amelia then goes back upstairs and resumes celebrating Sam's B-Day, just the two of them. End of movie.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Now, Duke. Now, that's like super broad strokes. I think this is one of the most intriguing films. And if you've done any research, if you've tried to like read any think pieces, listen to reviews, whatever, there are all kinds of different theories about how to interpret this film. And I've broken it down into three registers that I think will help us to talk about this film. One is we could see this as a straightforward monster film, right? And it's enjoyable from that level. And I think there's something interesting there. So we could talk about it at that level. Two, it's a film about repressed trauma, right? And it's an allegory. Or three, and this is kind of the fun one, we can talk about Babadook as a queer icon, because this is something that the internet has taken and totally run with, and Babadook has become a queer icon. So go ahead, Ryan, what were you going to say?
I was just going to say that as a monster fan, monster movie fan, you know, and coming from it from that angle from the first time, because I had heard that this movie was freaky, like super scary, actually scary. That's what I went into the movie going into. And so I think that the ending was as it definitely doesn't end like a normal monster movie, you know, not saying it has to, but it also kind of ends on a, you know, she's literally just befriending or has the Babadook, quote unquote, in her basement. And that's kind of a weird ending. And then her kid does a magic trick and hugs her.
Which is like a
cut to black.
An extremely good magic trick for
a Yeah, like a great one. Like with a dove. And you're like, what the fuck is going on? Which I hope we talk about that, whether that whole scene actually is even happening. Obviously, there's some theories about, you know, whether she actually even is her kid dead. Did she actually kill her kid? And this is like her dream, is she literally just demented and none of that's real at the end? Or is it kind of a mixture of both where she didn't kill her kid, but she is still dealing with the trauma? So kind of we're seeing it from this weird perspective. Anyway, there's all sorts of stuff we can go into. But from a monster movie fan, I don't know why he's switching the words. It was a little weird, the ending from the first one, but I like it more because it's obviously a super deep film. I like it more now.
Sure.
So like I knew when I said that, I knew that you were a fan of monster films. So what is successful about this film as a monster film, and then why is it weird? Like, do you like the monster? Is he scary? Is he creepy? Like,
yeah, absolutely. Oh, yeah. I mean, especially the whole I like the subgenre of let's take kid stuff and make it
creepy.
Fucking terrifying and evil, and you know, like killer clowns from outer space, whatever.
Yeah, I hate that fucking movie.
I like all that stuff. So the idea of a super scary kids book that has this kind of mythology to it is really cool to me, and I'd never seen done before, especially this well. And the monster itself, especially that scene where it goes in her mouth and then it's kind of going around her ceiling, the lighting's all awesome, and it's moving really fast, and that would freak you out in real life. And
there's some terrific character design aspects of it that I think
absolutely,
you know, obviously incorporating it as a child's storybook, and the way that he's introduced, he's got the top hat and he's got the trench coat and the long fingers and everything like that. But all of those things in isolation are so well chosen because you can hide those exact things in the corners of the frames, and in any other context, it'd be totally innocuous. But because you've read this book, all of a sudden, those things are charged with meaning. When she sees the hat rack at the police station, she, you know, her mind fills in the blanks. And when you watch the movie, there are moments where, like, they're kind of tricking you into your mind filling the blanks in. Like, in Amelia's room, there's a mannequin sort of in the corner, and it's just kind of tucked back there in the shadow. And it's just enough to give you the suggestion of a shape. Even when they're not trying to scare you, they still keep you on your toes with those little design elements like that.
Yeah, so what do we think of this reading? Like, is there justification to say that this is a monster film? Like, what is the Babadook from
Absolutely.
That reading?
Yeah, I think it straddles the line between sort of a ghost movie and a monster movie. It sort of plays with tropes of both subgenres. But I don't think it's unfair to call it both or one or the other. Yeah,
yeah, okay. It's a curse kind of movie, I guess. Ghost curse.
Sure,
but You get cursed, and then you're having to go through the consequences of that.
Not just that, but I was stricken on this rewatch at some of the similarities between this and a more recent film, Hereditary, that I didn't really think of The Babadook when I first watched Hereditary, but coming back to it now, I had forgotten about the sort of quasi-possession angle that they play with near the end of this film, before Essie Davis throws up the bile and all of that. All that kind of stuff had sort of not gone over my head when I first watched it, but I didn't really think about it in retrospect. To me, I just remembered, you know, oh, it's the creature. I remember the scare. I remember him floating across the kitchen and stuff like that. But then on this rewatch, I'm surprised that I literally was checking the time at the point that the Babadook first came into the movie, because I was surprised. It was about halfway through the film. It wasn't until the 46-minute mark that the Babadook actually shows up in the neighbor's house and you actually see his face. And before that, you only just see kind of suggestions of shapes and then that one scare in the police department that I mentioned before. But it's kind of crazy how well she ratchets up the tension in that first half of the movie without even introducing the monster. And I think that's all credit to a really solid script and a great filmmaker behind the camera and a great team in front of the camera enabling that vision. Yeah.
I didn't mention it at the outset, but you know, Ryan did the, you know, about the kid being great, but we also need to give a shout out to Essie Davis, because she is phenomenal in this, you know, like in the hands of a lesser performing artist, I don't know that you could maintain that build, right? Mm-hmm. Because you don't have the monster. It's really the first half of the film. It's a mother-son film.
Yeah.
You know? And that's why I mentioned in the recap that she becomes full-on monstrous feminine, which is something that you also see in Hereditary. And for people who are interested, there is a book by a film theorist named Barbara Creed who writes about this theme of the monstrous feminine. And it takes all kinds of different forms, right? Like, because we could kind of see... we kind of see Amelia as being a little bit of a Medea type of figure, right? Someone who goes mad, something pertaining to a husband, and then she gets revenge by taking it out on the child. So there's something there. You know, the witch theme is a monstrous feminine theme. The archaic mother is a theme, like the womb being this like site where demons are born and things like that, right? And so she, right? So there's all these... There's all these themes about the monstrous feminine in horror films. And Barbara Creed, she analyzes this. She's a, you know, a film theorist, but she kind of like does like a little psychoanalysis. So it's really interesting to kind of think about that.
I haven't read that. That sounds pretty interesting. I'll definitely make a note to check it out. But I would imagine she also kind of draws on the reality that, you know, we all kind of expect, or the societal we, I think there is this expectation that there's no closer bond than that between a mother and their child, or a parent and their child. And to test that and to put that kind of tension on it, and to have the mother in this film be so ambivalent towards her child, and in ways that he legitimately feels threatened and frightened and betrayed, which is just like one of those things that before this movie even becomes supernatural is like, yeah, you can understand why there's so much tension here. And I mean, that's got to be tough to navigate as an actor.
I kind of got it. I was like, this fucking kid sucks.
I agree. I don't think that's problematic.
I'm with you, brother.
Like, that kid is really, like, you know, he's a kid that only a mother could love. Like, it's...
Oh, it and really not even a mother a
tough,
could love.
Yeah, it's a tough road to hoe for her. Like, you genuinely feel for her. But then there's some stuff later on where it gets into those... I don't know why this is, but there's... This happens occasionally in movies, and it's very specifically triggering for me, is when parents will ply their children with junk food and ice cream and things Word like that. Life. And not just from like a junk food perspective, but anytime I see parents kind of like, you know, trying to bribe their kids essentially as in place of a mea culpa or something like that. It's just, it's so viscerally upsetting to me in a way that like all the Babadook sequences are great, but I had to retreat into my hoodie when she starts like coming out with those bowls of ice cream because her child's complaining about being hungry. And you're just like, this is a truly desperate situation. And it's
like, she just imagined murdering him. And it's like, well, here's a bowl of ice cream for you.
It's so fucking heartbreaking. Why don't you go eat shit? Like, it's so goddamn heartbreaking.
I'm a huge fan of the evil kid horror subgenre, right? The Omen is a favorite, The Good Son, and The Visitor from the 70s is one of the best. It's a rare film, but if you've ever seen The Visitor from the 70s, incredible.
That movie's so wild.
It's wild, yeah. But so I like it because it is a great theme, because kids are supposed to be these innocent, you know, people running, you know, trying to learn life, but really they can be evil, you know, in their own way. They don't know whether they know it or not. Some kids know it. But then the fact that you see a mom who is supposed to have unconditional love being faced with, oh my God, I can't do anything for this kid. It's such a like a empathetic situation where you're just like, yeah, I don't know what you would do. What do you do to that kid? You know, Problem Child's another great film. It's not a horror film.
Have you ever seen those Reddit forms of like scary shit that children say? There's, I can't remember one, but I can't remember the specifics of it, but there's one that I will never forget the basic gist of, which was like this father is reporting how he was taking a nap and his like 4-year-old daughter or 3-year-old daughter crawled up on top of him and he opened his eyes from his nap and she said, I want to tear your face off and wear it as my face.
Cool.
Jesus.
and he's like, Jesus, where did this come from?
I worked with a kid on 9/11 once, and the kid comes up to me and goes, Do you know how what the youngest person who died on 9/11 was? I'm like, no. He said like 2 months old. I'm like, Jesus, how do you know that? Why do you know that? You're like 9.
Well, but now doesn't that kind of relates to this kid Sam, right? Because he like just says shit.
Yeah.
Right? He just says whatever he's thinking. And the neighbor is like, oh, just like the father. And of course, Amelia can't deal with that. Amelia can't deal with like the sort of like free impulse of childhood expression, because that kind of reminds her of, you know, her dead husband, sure, which she has to repress. But like there is something about children who just kind of say stuff. And I think that's creepy because it challenges our norms of society. And one of the themes of this film is all about maintaining appearances, right? Like the child is difficult to deal with. So the school is like, oh, we're going to have a monitor follow him around. And there's that birthday party for their cousin. And all the like the suburban moms are all nicely dressed and their makeup is all perfect. And they're complaining about how they don't have time to go to the gym. And Amelia's sitting there like, oh, that must be really fucking hard.
Right.
Right. Like, oh, yeah. Suburban life is so difficult, you with your kind of like first world problems, right? So there's a lot of stuff kind of going on here about this order of appearances that are trying to be maintained, but that Sam just kind of like, with his just expression of honesty and truth, and he just kind of like bears witness to the trauma of the death of his father. That's kind of like, yeah, my father's dead. He's in a cemetery. He says it so nonchalantly and matter-of-factly, but society can't deal with that because that's too real. So, like, the real of childhood is something that you kind of have to, you turn into a monstrosity. You have to control it.
Oh, yeah. I was just going to say, it's also kind of interesting the way that Sam is, he is a terror. I think we're all
in accordance. He's the monster. He's one of the monsters.
We all agree.
Absolutely.
We all agree that he gives his mom a pretty hard time. But when you watch the movie, if you break down what he does or his motivation, at least, a lot of the time, he may be wreaking havoc, but it's like, oh, I'm doing this because I want to protect you. I want to, you know, I build all these weapons. And he's also, really technologically advanced in the same way that I think that magic trick at the end kind of puts a bow on the way that he has all these, he's really skilled with the way that he builds these weapons and stuff. And it may make her life much more difficult. But all of it is coming from, I think, a genuinely sweet place. He just doesn't know how to express himself, and it's and this is his way of expressing his love for his mother, is that, oh, I'm going to kill this monster for you with my baseball launcher or whatever. But instead, he just breaks a bunch of windows, and it just adds to her grief more and more. It's really, really tough. But it's such a delicately threaded needle, the way that she's able to wring that kind of tension in their relationship while having both of them still probably, it seems, genuinely love each other.
Yeah, and I think this is exacerbated by, again, that like suburban need to control anything that deviates from the quote norm. Like there's that one bit where she says, why can't you just be normal?
Yeah.
Right? Like, why can't you just be polite and just be obedient and obey the disciplinary mechanisms of the educational system and just be like the other kids? Why can't you just conform? But the real reason he can't just, quote, conform is because the trauma.
Yeah.
Right? He is born in trauma. Like, in a way, he's kind of part of the cause of the trauma. They were taking him to the hospital to be born, right?
And she blames him for that, certainly.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, absolutely. And I think that's so important because he's a physical reminder of this event, and she can't acknowledge that. That's why she can't, like, anytime someone mentions Oscar, she is like, shut up, let's not talk about that. Anytime he mentions the father, it's shut up, let's not talk about that. They bury his stuff down in the basement. And this will lead us to the second theme that I think is really important to think about this film. It's a film about repressed trauma, right? Like, I think it's we can see this as an allegory because you have the basement that is like the unconscious, where you place everything. You put it out of your purview of daily life, the life of order, right? The life of daily suburban appearances, the symbolic, the way you kind of normalcy, let's say. And then down there in the basement, that's where the chaos is. That's where the truth is. That's where the trauma is, right?
Mm-hmm. Sure, sure. And there's also something to that, and I don't know if this is a function of the way that, you know, horror cinematic vocabulary works, just that the basement is naturally scarier than the well-lit areas of the house, so that's where you're going to keep the monster. It just makes sense from a storytelling perspective. But I think it may not be coincidental that also, like, the basement is, you know, where the foundation of the house is built. Like, in a way that if you read this as a study of grief, because she's going through, you know, she goes through denial, she goes through bargaining with him, plying him with treats, you know, she has these outbursts of anger. And by the end of the movie, if this movie really is, you know, it's about grief and about how ultimately we learn to accept and live with our grief, that grief does become foundational to who we are. You know, we have to carry our trauma, and it does, it affects the way that we interact with others. And it can be for good or for ill, but, you know, whether or not it's haunting and traumatizing for her, that memory of losing her husband on the night that her son was born is undoubtedly, at this point, I would say maybe one of her core memories and one of her most foundational moments in her life. And that was one of those things that, like, it may be a little bit of a stretch on a symbolic level, but I do like that it's, well, you know, the Babadook is part of my core. It's part of my foundation. So down with the cement he goes, you know.
I think also to go back to the kid and how, you know, problematic he is as a kid, but, you know, he also is just a kid at the end of the day. He right. doesn't change that throughout the film, really. He's the same kid kind of at the end. He doesn't have the big aha moment. Like you said, he was born in trauma. So to him, he doesn't know any better. It's just like, yeah, like you said, he's always had his dad in the cemetery, no big deal. The mom had all these expectations building up to, you know, her first kid, this idyllic life that they were going to have. And like you said, all of it was ripped away in an instant. Not only did she lose her her husband, but she got this demon spawn of Satan as a kid that she has to raise by herself. So now she's, like, literally from the outset of the film in the worst situation compared to what society, you know, and her version of it.
Yeah.
Like, oh, wow, my whole normal life is now ripped from me. But then, like you said, she learns to accept it. And at the end, she's just happy, even though the monster is still there. She has to feed it worms every day. Just kind of give it a little bit of food, get a little bit of attention, you know, make sure, all right, it's there. That's right. We're cool. We're all cool. The monster's still here. All right, we're good. Let's go sell. Let's
She's
go have
kind
a birthday
of compartmentalized
party.
Compartmentalized it and figured out a way to nurture the grief without giving in to it.
Right.
That's right. Yeah, because the child, he says you can never get rid of it.
Yeah.
So you never get rid of the grief. You never get rid of the trauma. But in psychoanalytic terms, you can become adjusted to it.
Sure, absolutely. And you can learn from it and learn new techniques to cope with it.
I maintain, though, that I feel like the crazy, insane magic trick with the dove is maybe her hinting that either, like, we're taking the positive view, optimistic view of what this movie could be the end, but it could be it's all she's crazy at the end, basically. The Shutter Island ending of Babadook.
Yeah, what is the purpose of him doing magic?
Insane magic.
So there are some interesting themes.
It was too crazy for a kid.
He's learning, and he's doing these performances, because what does he always say? He's like,
nothing in my
but
hands,
remember
nothing in
that
my hands.
Things are treacherous, right? Like, reality is treacherous. And so, like, that's one of the themes that he learns when he's, like, following this magician guy. And then I guess there are some other themes too. Like, when she's watching TV, there's, like, the cartoon where the wolf, like, puts on the sheep's clothing, which is kind of like a hidden, like, the real truth is buried.
Like,
is
it, you're right. The kid's dead. You're 100%. He's dead.
Well, there's a lot of stuff. I mean, this gets into the just the overall influences from which Jennifer Kent is drawing.
Lars von Trier.
What's that? Oh yeah, that. But I mean, in the movie, there are sequences, there are montages that are cut from like Georges Méliès films, and one of his Spanish contemporaries. I wrote this down. Segunda de Chaman. One of the clips in that montage is from one of his short films. And both of those guys before, or at least Georges Méliès was. I'm not 100% sure about de Chaman, but both of those guys, or excuse me, Georges Méliès at least before becoming a filmmaker, he was a magician, and a lot of his early shorts were him sort of incorporating magic into stagecraft and trying to use the camera as an extra an extra tool to incorporate or increase his magic tricks or plus them up a little bit and just try to figure out a way to take that to a different format. So I wouldn't be surprised if it has something to do with that, just kind of the way that this film overall is, it pays a lot of homage to early cinema and just the magic of the art form and things like that.
Yeah, so I have a theory, and my theory extends to all horror films. And I think it's best expressed in a film like Cabin in the Woods or in a film like this. And I was actually thinking about Cabin in the Woods for this precise reason. And this reminds me of this as well, because also another one of the black and white films that we see them watching is Phantom of the Opera with Lon Chaney, right? And so there's something about the grotesque and the monstrous. And then again, with that sheep that is like the wolf, but it's a wolf in sheep's clothing. There's something about like, what is the truth inside beyond the appearances? And what is the truth inside beyond the appearances and the unconscious? It's the monstrosity. It's the monster. And so in a film like Cabin in the Woods, the monstrosity, they live below the earth, right? It's the ancients that have to be satisfied through horror films where you have a virgin and then the athlete and all these people have to be sacrificed to placate the unconscious from coming back, which is like the return of the repressed. So we have to keep them at bay by satisfying them. And then Cabin in the Woods basically says, that's why we like horror films, because horror films, they show us the monstrosity of who we are, but it allows us to also kind of like placate our sexual and physical and whatever desires, right? And so we can kind of, we don't have to like fully express the monstrosities that we are, you know? We don't fully live, you know, in that way, which is why it's so awesome when they just like fucking release the button and all the monsters come out all at once. It's like, yeah, you want monsters? Here you go. Every fucking monster that human beings could ever imagine, there you go. This one is more subtle, but I think it's doing something similar, right? It's grief is that monster that you can never get rid of. It's something that's beneath the surface, and we have to learn to live with it, to be adjusted to it, to kind of feed it, to placate it so that it doesn't haunt us, so that it doesn't cause us to ravage life above the surface, like where we strangle dogs and kill our children. But we can figure out a way to kind of be like, okay, I've got this thing down beneath the surface, and I can feed it a little bit of something. Yeah. It needs life. Like, what's the purpose of it eating the earthworms? Is there something like substantial in that? Like, is there something about it being
death,
earthy,
decay,
wormy? There's something.
Yeah, I can
what
see
is
that.
Death and decay. So,
Ryan says death and decay.
Decay?
In the short film that is kind of an inspiration for this that she did a few years before, the monster
called
is,
Monster.
The monster's left with a bottle of milk in that one, which is, you know, maybe you could read into the maternal
motherly
aspects of that.
Maternal,
but,
yeah.
But I think it all just comes back to that that notion of like, You may want to deny your grief, your trauma, whatever, but it's part of you, and you have to nourish it specifically. You have to meet it on its own terms in order to process it and learn to accept it. And yeah, I think in this one the earthworms I think are a lot more fun than the bottle of milk, especially because the kid is helping her with it.
Mm.
You know,
it's their trauma. It's not just her trauma.
The thing is, though, is that there is a big disconnect between the two of them with regards to the trauma they experience, because he, in his experience, he's never really had a dad at all. He lost his dad that night. So there's, you know, he never knew the person that he lost in a way that, like, I had a friend, I won't go into too much detail just because to protect their own privacy, but I had a friend who lost her father when we were in high school. And she told me one of the hardest parts was that her mom lost a husband, but she had lost a father, and they couldn't really see eye to eye on that. Mm. And that kind of kept them separate a little bit, and it made it difficult for them to learn how to comfort each other through this. And I can imagine how isolated Amelia must feel in this, because her son didn't have a loss at all. He was just born with a single mother, essentially. You know, he never knew his dad enough to lose him. So that's another thing that kind of, it's such a unique relationship dynamic in this film. I think it's a very good script.
Yeah, so there's like a Freudian interpretation here, and I don't mean in like the weird sense that we think of Freud, where like the kid wants to fuck the mom and kill the father. Oh, yeah. But there's a way to open this up. There's a way to open this up in a less sort of like explicit way that like other psychoanalysts do, which is about like desire and attention. And this child, Sam, like he is overly dependent on his mother's attention and affection. Like, remember the bit where she's trying to get her rocks off and she's got her vibrator out, and right before climax it gets interrupted. Like, she can't enjoy even. Her source of enjoyment has been taken from her in the pleasure sense, because now her whole life is lived to nurturing this child. But this child has like an unlimited stream of access to her, which doesn't allow her to have any of those elements of herself. Like, even that coworker that's clearly flirting with her, you know, she may enjoy the attention, but she can't quite give herself to actually reach fulfillment in that, because she's been kind of cut off from that. There's a sort of like stunting, a castration, if you will, that doesn't allow her to find any source of enjoyment. So I think there's something there about like desire and unfulfillment, and like the father being like he's not in the trio, and you kind of need all three, at least from the kind of like psychoanalytic perspective, to create a sort of like adjusted household.
You bring up that side character, and I think it brings up an interesting point about this film, that I think there are a lot of lesser films that would have that early love interest play a bigger role later in, that he would be one of the victims. But I really love that this movie just abandons him when Amelia starts abandoning people, like almost as though he exists in the script specifically so they can illustrate how completely Amelia is isolating herself from the outside world, you know, because he's a pretty significant presence in the first half and then just disappears. And in the same way that the neighbor who has Parkinson's disease, that you would think in a lot of movies that would be setting something up, that she would be trying to get into her car and her hands would start to shake when she's unlocking the door to escape from the Babadook or something. But no, it's just a human touch that adds a little something, a little background and a little character to her without you know, getting in the way or being a setup for a cheap gag. And I really admire that about the script. It does all these things that in a conventional horror film would be indicating to the audience that they're going to go for a really cheap or unearned scare or something like that.
To piggyback on what y'all are saying, and also to go back to that dove magic trick,
you will not let this
I do. When I was listening to y'all, I think that I figured it out. Or at least a new interpretation of it.
Lay it on us.
She had like we said, she had everything ripped from her. All the magic was gone in her life, disappeared all of a sudden. There's no magic. Everything sucks and shit. She had the Babadook have to come and scare her to basically realize, oh, wait, there is some magic. And then in the end, it ends on a hopeful note. And the kid, all kids think it's just magic is real. You know, kids are magical, you know, innocent. So the fact that he does that dove trick, it's maybe the filmmaker saying, like, just talking about how he believes life hasn't been ruined for him yet, even though he also has gone through this traumatic experience. So why can't she just accept it and enjoy life even amidst the pain, the grief, the trauma, the suffering that life brings at you every day, baby? That's my new interpretation.
Okay, so this will be the last this will be the last thing. Let's talk about this, and then we'll kind of transition into the mailbag and stuff like that. But this is a question. A lot of people talk about how vague this film is. That's what they say. They say that it's not really clear. Is this monster real? Is it repressed trauma? What is it? But here's my question. There's one particular scene that I think kind of lends itself to the fact that actually this is repressed trauma, and that she is the creator of the Babadook. And it's one when they're in the police station and the black chalk is all over her hands, indicating that she has drawn this. And that's related to when she's at the birthday party and they say, what did you used to do? And she used to write children's stories. Mm-hmm. So here's my thing. I think that the better reading of this film is that she was the Babadook all along, that the Babadook and that she wrote the story. She reassembled the book. And that's her, in a way, almost externalizing this grief to in order to frighten her child as a sort of like revenge. And this is why I said the Medea figure. So what do you think about that? Do you think that am I stretching it, or is there enough evidence?
I think you're stretching it, but it sounds awesome. And I like that interpretation.
It's definitely a fun interpretation. I always thought that it was soot on her hands because it's right after she burns the book
That's intentionally vague. That's what I thought the first time that I watched it. And then I watched it this time and I said, oh no, because she wrote children's books.
That's a good call. I didn't put those two together, but I mean that wouldn't surprise me. This is a very carefully considered script, so that would be a fun little wrinkle to play with. If you were to rewatch it just in that light, I wonder if you could pick out more little pieces of evidence to support that.
Yeah. Okay, and then the very last thing, just because we have to do it, because this has happened since, I think, about 2015, 2016, Babadook has become an online queer icon. Okay, do you guys know about this, and do you have any comments on
this? No. Explain it to me.
Raymond, do you know about this?
Yes. I think I mentioned it in the first conversation.
People dressing like the Babadook?
Well, basically, you know how Netflix will have those little algorithmically designed subgenres? Like, right now they've got a Black Lives Matter collection. They have, you know, they probably have, scary stories for Halloween. So a while back, they had one of those subsections that basically said LGBTQ stories. And in the midst of a bunch of movies that were about LGBT love stories or just incorporating those kinds of characters, there was just the Babadook right in the middle of it.
Yeah.
And it was just one of those things where, like, clearly there was something off about the algorithm and it just somehow ended up there. But the internet just took it and ran with it. And that year at Pride, there were a bunch of people. It's great. I mean, this year when I remember there were two or three Babadook references that I saw at the Pride March, which it's stuck around for better or worse. I think
it's awesome.
I think it's been fully
embraced. to put a little meat on it, the reason now that people are writing think pieces, there are actually some Vox pieces and Guardian pieces. You can actually read this by queer authors who are saying this is why. And they say, is it satire? Is it sardonic? Like, maybe. But the point is that the reason is that what you have is a figure who is androgynous, and this figure disrupts domestic, let's say, typical heteronormative life by causing chaos, by kind of like confronting a white heteronormative family that is dealing with the sort of repression of an Oedipal male-female child, typical
male
suburban relationship. Okay. And so that is this kind of like queerness. And queer not in the sense of explicitly being homosexual, but queer in the sense of being askew, different, outside, excessive of, beyond, you know, kind of the quote weird, but in a positive way of stranging, of queering, if you will, this otherwise domestic, you know, suburban story. And so that's kind of, so then people are like, you know, there are all these like great Twitter accounts that are like, you know, you can't tell me that the Babadook isn't like the greatest queer icon of the last decade and stuff like that. So they're totally running with it and owning it. And it's really kind of amazing.
Now, are you saying that the person who's behind putting these movies in these playlists on Netflix thought that when they put it in there? Or they say that was an accident? Now we're trying to backlog that.
All of Netflix's stuff is algorithmic. So there wasn't somebody going through and going, oh, I'm reading this. It was literally, I don't know if they ever accounted for it. It was just one of those things, like a little glitch in the matrix, so to speak.
Okay.
So it was an accident.
But I do love how much the community has just picked it up and run with it, and that it's just, well, he's ours now, so you guys.
That's right.
Like, straights get fucked. Babadook is ours.
That's right. Well, I think on that note, let's go ahead and wrap up the discussion of this film. I think we all agree it's worth a watch if you haven't seen it. You know, email us with any questions, thoughts, theories. What do you guys think about it? We're going to transition now into the mailbag.
Can I say
and,
one
we've
thing?
Got. Oh, yeah, go ahead, Raymond.
Before the mailbag, just real quick, I just want to do a real quick appreciation corner for the art department on this movie. This set is incredible. The production designer, Alex Holmes, who's the co-art director with Karen Hannaford, they did all this incredible stuff with the house, casting it primarily in blues and grays. All the finishing, the doorways are in black. The pine wood floors are finished three times over in black varnish. And it just gives this quality that, like, when working hand in hand with Heather Wallace's wardrobe design, which predominantly puts Essie Davis and Pink's, like, it's just this overcast apartment that's constantly crushing her.
Shit.
And it's just, it's just,
and
so,
he's gone again.
It's so cool.
Right. Well, to the mailbag.
To wrap this up, I will say, to the mailbag, it is important to always give a shout out to the art department because they're the unsung heroes in these types of films. Production, things like that, they never get any love. So you definitely got to
pay. This is literally an art house film.
It is.
You need the art department for that.
But, chink. Okay. So what we're going to do is we're going to jump into the mailbag. We have one voicemail this week that we're going to talk about. It comes from Ryan. Just as a reminder, if you want to give us a call, you can email us at 1-213-534-8807. That's 1-213-534-8807. And you can leave a voicemail as Ryan did. So let's turn it over to Ryan.
Hey Wisecrack, this is Ryan B., longtime fan. I just wanted to comment on the I've Been Thinking of Ending Things movie. Truly awful movie, don't get me wrong, but I did want to add something that I think might add to the quality of this truly awful movie, and it relates to an interview I read about Synecdoche, New York, when Kaufman had said that he worried that film was a dead art form because there was a limited interaction between the artist and the audience. And so he wanted to create a movie that was different every time you watched it. So that vague quality in Synecdoche, New York, and in I'm Thinking of Ending Things, where people, you know, come in and out of roles and even change names and dynamics in their relationship, I think reflects the way that when the audience sits down and watches the movie again, maybe 5 years later, whether they're in a happy relationship or had just gone through a breakup or they're maybe dealing with the fact that their parents might die soon. All of those things are supposed to be present in the audience's mind while they're watching these movies. And I think that's integral to the process. So I just thought I'd give him, you know, the benefit of the doubt there. Still, it was an awful movie. Thank you. Thanks for everything you do, guys. Bye.
Yeah. Thank you, Ryan. All right. Let me kick this over to the other Ryan. Our Ryan. What do you think?
Yeah. So I'm a huge Charlie Kaufman head, and I think that his scripts are so well written and dense usually, and you do pick up a lot on a rewatch of Being John Malkovich, adaptation, Eternal Sunshine, all these movies that had directors, I think, that kind of probably took his long monologues and chopped them down and was like, all right, we don't need to do this part where you have the actors going in and out. Because his movies, he goes, I think, way too overboard on that stuff. I love Synecdoche, New York. I think it works, but also, it works for me. I know it doesn't work for everybody, and I get that. But this movie, I think he took that to a whole other level and in a way that just wasn't entertaining. At the end of the day, that's what you got to do for your movie. It would be a little entertaining, and I think that he just went so far into the conceptual, what if these characters meant this and whatever. Like, that movie just sucked and is up so far up its own ass, it's not even worth analyzing a lot of it. But, I hope he takes a hold of this thing he's trying to do, like this guy explained, and does a good version of it soon. Sorry,
what do you think,
sorry,
Raymond?
Charlie, if you're watching this.
I know.
Well,
what do you think, Raymond?
I'm glad that Ryan got another chance to talk about this because I think we talked about it last week. I had to tag team with Michael to try and defend the movie a little bit. I don't think it's an awful movie, but I do recognize the criticisms of it, and I do think a lot of the criticism surrounding it is valid. But I still think it's worthwhile. I think it's an interesting flick. And I don't know. If you're interested on my thoughts on it, I talked a little bit more about it last week, but we're running short on time now.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it really comes down to what is a film. Like Ryan just said, it's about entertaining. And so for me, sure, I actually really enjoy like the films of Béla-Tarr, for example, who's one of my favorite filmmakers, and slow cinema. And they're not entertaining. They're polarizing.
Well, hold on a minute. By entertaining, I don't mean it has to be Michael Bay, you know, special effects, you know, whatever. I love slow cinema too. That's entertaining, but you can't punish your audience and expect it to be like, oh, well, that's what I meant to do, is make it not fun to watch.
I wouldn't call I'm Thinking of Anything's a punishing experience. It's certainly, sometimes it feels like it's looking for a purpose or looking for meaning, and maybe it could have been a little bit cleaner or more direct or less obtuse.
That's a good way to put it.
But I think there's still some stuff. He's playing with cinematic language in a lot of scenes, and I find it particularly compelling at certain points. But I do agree that he made a movie that's pretty tough to defend. Unless, because a lot of people say, oh, you either love it or you hate it. And it's like, I didn't hate it, but I don't love it enough to go to the mat for it. I think it's a pretty interesting film. And for what it's worth, I'm glad that it's out there. And I'm also glad that he got to make a Charlie Kaufman movie out of something that wasn't his source material. He still figured out a way to tell his story.
For sure.
We are
the real Brady Bros.
Brady Brothers from the TV show Brady Bunch. I'm Barry Williams.
And I'm Christopher Knight.
I played Greg, and who were you again?
I played Peter.
We've decided that we're going to do a podcast around episodes of the Brady Bunch. We're going to use it as a prism to look back to our experience doing the show and why the Brady Bunch is still popular.
Have a sunshine day.
We are the real Brady Bros.
All right, so again, if you have any further comments on all this madness, you can call us, or alternatively, you can email us, and I'm going to jump into the email portion of the mailbag now. You can email us at movies@wisecrack.co. That's C-O, not com. So movies@wisecrack.co. All right, so this one is more of a broad kind of request about something that we could or maybe should discuss, and I wanted to feed it to you guys. This comes from D. D says, hello, folks. You guys have to discuss Alex Proyas' classic film, Dark City, from 1998.
Oh, hell yeah.
It has a lot of philosophy in it, philosophy of the self, of identity, memories, origins, film noir, etc., etc. I hope that you guys choose to watch and discuss this film without having to place it in a poll. So let me just ask you all, what are your thoughts of Dark City, if we can do so in a short amount of time without maybe having to do a full episode, or maybe we will do a full episode in the future. Give us a little teaser.
Ryan, you had a pretty strong reaction to that. What do you think?
I mean, it's just a great cult film that Alex Proyas knows how to make, build a world, we'll say. And he has really cool, heady concepts that are executed super well. Dark City's right up there with his best work. So highly recommend anyone going to see it if you haven't seen it already. In terms of doing this podcast, you know, we always talk about candies and vegetables. At least we did back in the day. Jared would say, all right, if we're going to do, you know, a Transformers, we got to do like four Transformers if we want to do one, whatever this movie was. What movie were we talking about? Dark City.
You know? No, I thought you were like The Babadook.
No. Well, The Babadook, I don't know. I guess it's kind of gotten more of a mainstream appeal.
So Dark City is a broccoli's kind of film.
I love it.
I don't even think of it as vegetables. I think it's a pretty entertaining movie.
It's not about entertaining. It's about how many people know about the movie.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, Dark City is not going to get those clicks, baby.
Sure. That's
good. Yeah.
I don't know.
Like Borat will.
I haven't seen Dark City in a long time. I remember thinking it was just okay, but maybe if I watched it again, there might have been some stuff that I didn't really latch on to that I may enjoy more on a rewatch. So I'd be down to watch it with you guys.
Cool. All right. And then so the last email that we'll get into comes from Adam. He says, hey, Wisecrack, been thinking about the Social Dilemma documentary. And I remember a part where one of the talking heads says something to the effect of, we're raising a generation that has been trained to react to stress by seeking comfort in their phones. The idea being that this is socially stunting our youth and harming society. My question is, at what time did society in general have healthy coping mechanisms? The way I see it, in decades past, the general reaction was to look for comfort in a bottle of alcohol, pack of cigarettes, or by simply repressing emotions in general. Is this an accurate view, or am I being too dismissive of past generations' mental health? Thank you for the podcast. Big fan. Hope you keep making these for a long time to come.
That's so exactly where my head was during the podcast. Was hey, if you think about it, yeah, this is unique with the technology involved, but really the same social and psychological problems we've had. It's people. Advertisers with money trying to get us to buy stuff, and this time they're just using algorithms. And back in the day, how would you placate yourself? How would you spend your time, your free time, your leisure time? For one, you didn't have a lot of leisure time back in the day, so that wasn't as much of an issue. But yeah, what, you'd play with the ball?
Play with the ball.
Yeah, you just play with the ball, kick a ball, throw things over the fence, throw the stick over the pigs. And anyway, now we have a lot more leisure time. And yeah, I get it that it's that you want to use it or have your kids not grow up like zombies and stuff. Like, this is a new problem, but I definitely think it's kind of more the same in terms of the generational issue. What do y'all think?
I have a lot of thoughts on this, but in the interest of brevity,
keep them quick.
The interest of brevity, I think you're probably hitting on something, Ryan, and Austin, you kind of mentioned the same, that or I think it was the email that sort of jumped to this point, that, you know, humans are going to have addictive personalities, and we will find avenues for those addictions or that compulsive behavior. And I have serious issues with social media. I think there are a lot of issues to be addressed with social media, but I think there's a lot more dangerous stuff out there.
One thing I will say about that, because I have thought about that conversation about the social dilemma, and we really didn't talk about the political stuff that much in that conversation, or the political implications, political misinformation, fact-checking, and all that stuff. We really kind of were... I feel like I was being a little dismissive in the conversation too, but really what I was talking about was, people trying to sell me shoes and stuff, and me feeling like I have the force of will to fight that off. But, you know, mass political disinformation, especially with like other governments and stuff, that's a whole other conversation we should have sometime about the social dilemma.
Yeah, I guess the real issue is there ever a time that we can romanticize and say that was the pure past when we had
thing. Things
that's
have
right.
been fucked. Forever. And honestly, this is the time, baby. This is the best time that has ever happened. This moment. Live it, Mr. Internet people out there. Mr. and Mrs. Internet people, you're in the best time ever. Show me the meaning.
Ryan is going to be our champion, sloganeering of positivity. This is the best time ever. So if you want to contribute to the best time in society, you can call us again at 1213-534-8807, or you can email us movies@wisecrack.co. Oh, all right, everybody, let's sign off. Where can we find y'all on the internet?
You can find me, literally, you have a computer, the most powerful computer ever, on your phone. You're walking around with it everywhere. It's fucking insane. You can order food, cars, anything, plane tickets, and you can go to Ryan Shorts on YouTube or Twitter or whatever, and Ryan's Game Show, and just find stuff there. I got a new Paranormal Activity short that's up there right now. I mean, wow, I made it on my phone too. I mean, are you kidding me? I made a movie on my phone, and about, you know, thousands of people are about to watch it, hopefully.
Yeah, take that, New
Best
Hollywood.
Time
you guys
ever.
Needed budgets, and you needed stories, and you needed film stock. We can just do it now on a freaking monthly payment plan that we have with our technology.
Look, 2020 is it sucks, whatever, but guess what? It's also awesome,
too. Best time ever.
It's the best time ever, but also I get it. Sometimes the best times ever, there's the worst times ever in the middle of it. It's okay. We'll get through it. Let's go.
Raymond, where can people find you on the internet?
Okay, you can find me on Twitter and Letterboxd at Crematoria. My name's up there on the list or whatever, or on the video right now. Another thing is, Ryan, since you plugged one of your shorts, I'm definitely going to check out your paranormal short.
Thank you.
A few years ago, I did my first short film, and it's a little fun-sized fright flick that's perfect for Halloween. So if you're looking for something fun to start off your horror movie watching this year,
What's it called?
I'll re-up a link to it on my Twitter. So go ahead and check out my Twitter, @Crematoria, and I'll post a new link to my first short, Little Pigs.
Little Pigs.
Amazing. That sounds great. And you can hit me up on Twitter, Austin_Hayden. My Instagram is AUS_HAY. I too dabble in filmmaking. We just released a feature film this year that was an adaptation of a book. It's like an experimental avant-garde montage cinema directed by the Canadian wunderkind Isaiah Medina that I produced. That you can find, it's called
awesome.
Inventing the Future. It's live on YouTube. You can just check out my IMDb. My name is Austin Hayden Smith, but my IMDb is Austin Hayden. So whatever, you can find my stuff. But yeah, all right. We love you. Happy
One
Halloween.
More thing. Happy Halloween,
Spooky
everybody.
Oh, yeah.
Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween.
Have a safe holiday.
Yeah. Ryan, send us out, brother.
Show me the meaning. Happy Halloween from Wisecrack.
Trick or treat. Smell my feet.